Who's going to go? Kings?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Hold on, I gotta do all the formalities.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Please rise and all.
You're in your venue.
We'll call the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee to order. We're continuing the public hearing on Senate Bill 5523. So we're going to reopen the hearing today. We're continuing. Senate Bill 5523 is the Judicial Department budget. We left off yesterday, and the Chief Justice is here. Mr. Chief Justice, would you like to continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I should understand that. Pardon me for stepping on your lines. I do the same thing in our court, but it's I'm speaking to the tape. And I would say this is the time set for oral argument in the case of State versus Jones. And, of course, the lawyers who drove all the way down from Portland said, well, duh, what do you think we're here for? And but it is, at least in our cases, I suspicion yours, for Chris's benefit. And the tapes, when they go back, when we go back.
When somebody in history reviews our tape, the tapes of this day.
So I apologize for stepping on your lines. My first opportunity is to briefly introduce Tim Willis, who is the vice chair of the Gleaves Committee report. And I originally, with the question Kings and I kicked around was, I'll be quite frank, we have another wonderful report from the Gleaves Committee, soon to be the Willis Committee, I suspicion. But we're also aware of the dollar problems we have and the likelihood of getting any new judges perhaps is minuscule. But I think the effort is worthwhile, and I'm confident that Mr. Willis will explain some of the things you've already raised on efficiencies and effectiveness and what goes on, because one of the major tools we use in determining, and Tim will explain it to you, most of you will recall from previous meetings, it's a rather rigorous opportunity for the districts that want to have a new judge to demonstrate that they're doing everything they can in terms of EDR and other things in order to justify adding judicial personnel. So the State Court Administrator and I concluded, Chief concluded, and I agreed that it would be important to have Mr. Willis come in Mr. Gleaves' absence. He was invited, but his wife is not well at the moment. And so Tim, who is our vice chair and has taken a wonderful leadership role in this from Benton County, lawyer in practice there, will give the Gleaves Committee report to give you an update on where we are in judgeships in Oregon. So, Mr. Willis, would you join us?
Well, sure. Mr. Willis, welcome to the committee. Please pass along our best to Mr. Gleaves and Mr. Willis.
I did talk to him yesterday, and he sends his regrets. The job I've been assigned is to introduce you to several handouts that I think you've just received today. One is our report to you, and the other is a more recent comparison.
I don't think we've received handouts quite yet. So
maybe you are in the process of receiving.
And we're slow enough to begin with, so we don't want you to get too far ahead of us.
All right. Now, I've been called a lot of things over the years, but I can't remember the last time I was called naive. So I recognize that while there may not be funding for additional judgeships, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a need for those judgeships. And I think what I'd like to do today is explain what we've done, what our recommendations have done. And I think it's important for the committee to know that, even though you may be dealing with other pressing issues as far as money goes. The committee itself has been around for about 12 years. The purpose of the committee is to assist the legislature in collecting information and then making recommendations on where there may be a need for new judgeships, and we also do a priority, what we think are the most important priorities for new judgeships. That's what this report is, the big report that's dated November 15, 2002. There are two basic methods that we use to bring this information to you. The first, as the chief has indicated to you, beginning with the last legislative session, we were able to do a fairly sophisticated statistical study that helps us determine what the need might be. The National Center for State Courts came in, and we paid them to do a case workload study, and based on that, they made a determination on the average time that it takes to process cases. They then took that and applied that to the case filings through the different districts in Oregon for 1999 and came up with a report that we presented to the 2001 Legislative Committee. From that report, the committee recommended and the legislature passed 6 additional judgeships. What we've done with this report to you, we've updated it using their method, but applying it to the case filings in 2001. And that's what's contained in this report. So that gives us a little better statistical information than we've had in the past. The second thing that we do to glean information and look at need, we allow the judicial districts, and there's 27 judicial districts for the 36 Oregon counties. We allow the judicial districts that have an interest or have requested new judgeships to make a presentation to us, and that allows them to make their pitch to us. We've always felt that it was a responsibility to question and interview them. And one thing that we always do is talk to them about efficiency. We think that's really important, and so we quiz them on their technological advances, what alternate dispute resolution procedures they're using. And the interesting thing is this latest thing that we have just received from the National Center for State Courts. And what it did was do a comparison between Oregon, Colorado, California, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Those are states where they have done somewhat similar studies. It's always a little difficult to compare, but what I like is the comment down below the chart. It says it does appear that in general judges in Oregon are resolving cases more quickly and efficiently than in other western states where there is comparable data. I'd like to take credit that the committee's done all this, but it is certainly the districts that have worked on their efficiency too, and they've been forced to do that because of the lack of funds. But it's basically those two methods that we use to present this to the court. One reason we just don't go on the statistical information is that each judicial district has sort of unique problems, and that's something that I think we need to consider. And if you have time to go through the report, each district, we cover each one that's made a recommendation and talked about some of the unique problems that they have in that district. The number one priority in our report is the Umatilla-Moro Judicial District. It's an interesting district in that it's a two-prison district. They just finished the Two Rivers facility in Umatilla. I think that's an 1,800-bed facility. They already had the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute in Pendleton, which is like a 1,600-bed. Those types of facilities generate a lot of work for the local trial courts with post-conviction relief petitions and a number of things. That's one of the unusual factors for that district. It also has a high Hispanic population and the need for interpreters and the impact on the court process. We kind of tried to explain that in our little synopsis of each district to you, but that was our number one priority recommendation to you in the report. I think maybe I have one opinion I'd like to express. I think if I jumped up on this table and screamed at you, that wouldn't overemphasize the concern that I have on what I see happening to the Oregon judicial system because of the budget cuts, not just for new judges, but certainly what's happened there. And it's kind of a personal observation. I'm in private practice in Corvallis. I graduated from Willamette, went down there almost 27 years ago. I really no longer have a trial practice, so I'm not really beholden to the trial court judges. They don't do much to buy my groceries. But I really serve on this committee because of my belief that the judicial system is really important for Oregon. And I do have a background. When I first got down there, you do the usual court appointments. So I've done criminal defense, juvenile, mental commitment hearings, progressed into some personal injury, mainly family law and commercial litigation, and now I'm just basically business, real estate, estate planning, but have that as the background. And the concern I have, and I just happened to call one of our circuit court judges before I came up here today, and maybe this is more as a citizen than on my committee, but I'm really concerned about the morale of the judges and staff down there. Hank Dickerson is a circuit court judge down there. He was sworn on the bench in January of 1983, so he's been in the saddle for over 20 years down there. And I talked to him, and he said in his 20 years there, he's never had the situation where he's lost so much good staff, been unable to hire new staff, had cases deferred, the court closure on Friday. He's never seen anything like that before, and really has expressed some frustration and concern, and you know, I'd just like to pass that on to you. And then just from my past experience in doing trial work, I know that it was always important for my clients to get a decision. It wasn't always the decision that they wanted, but it gave them a decision and the ability to go on. And what I see happening now is either an inordinate delay in getting to court, or maybe not even being able to present the case themselves. And that's a real concern for me. And kind of a final issue that Hank Dickerson told me, he's seen an awful lot of the criminal practice in Benton County over 20 years, and he said a lot of the criminal defendants may not have made the right decisions in their life, and that's why they're before him, but a lot of them aren't dumb. And if they see that they're not going to be prosecuted, that's not really a very good situation for the communities. And those are a couple of personal concerns that I have that I think are really important. And I really see the trial court, and that's kind of the committee that we're serving as sort of the people's court. And I think they expect that court to be able to deal with criminal, juvenile, domestic, you know, property, personal injury, business situations. And I see that changing, and it's a real concern. So that's kind of my personal plug why I think it's really important that you think about this and deal with the court budget issues.
Mr. Willis, question on the new report for this biennium. Did that include the inclusion of all six judges?
That's not a very good question. That's assuming that the six judges are in place. And so this is a need base that the six judges are already serving, and I recognize that the last three don't go on until the end of June. But this report, the need that was based on this, already assumed that those six judges were in place. And that kind of brings up a good question, that we're sometimes our committee is kind of frustrated because of the identification of the need and the time that the new judges are put in. I mean, in the 2001 legislature, the need was identified by the case filings in 1999. We got a report in 2000, took it to the legislature in 2001. They passed and approved six judges, three of which I think went into effect in January of 2003, the other three, you know, the end of June of 2003. And so by the time we established the need and the new judgeships, there was quite a gap there. And I'm fairly confident the situation hadn't improved during that time.
Okay. I just needed to know that.
No, that's a very good question. I appreciate you asking that. Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Chief Justice used a term that I'm not familiar with, and I think I know what it is. I think it was ADR. Is that average daily rulings? Is that what it is? I don't know. I charge for those acronyms in my committee, but based upon it somewhere, I guess.
Representative Butler, I should have known better. You forewarned me that there's a charge, or somebody did, there's a charge in your committee for using acronyms just the way I grew up. Now, ADR is normally, as you know, alternative dispute resolution. In this state, because it's an important part of what we do, it's called appropriate, because in our way of thinking, mediation, arbitration, case settlement are just a series of the tools that include trial by jury. It's not anti-trial by jury. They're in a continuum. And so we use ADR to mean appropriate dispute resolution, and that normally is considered as mediation arbitration.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I was vague on that.
All right. Other questions for Mr. Willis? I certainly appreciate you being here today. I know that you put a lot of work in. I know that you and the rest of the committee put a lot of work and efficiencies in. But I do have to ask you this question in light of what we're dealing with. You look at judicial workload around the state. I know that, you know, and I also know that people can't be on your commission. My understanding is somebody can't be on your commission if they're asking for new judgeships.
That's what we try to do.
They can't have a representative from those candidates. That's why you have a lot from your jurisdiction represent.
I see that. I've got representation from both Burns, Oregon, and Baker City, Oregon, and I appreciate it.
But they weren't requesting new judgeships. But the committee is faced with some very, very and the state is faced with some very, very difficult budget situations. And we have asked the court about the possible consolidation of some of the judicial districts. To put you on the spot, I'm putting you on the spot because you are vice chair in this committee, but mm-hmm. I would be interested, should, in your opinion, or maybe an opportunity before we get to the court's budget for the Cleaves Commission to talk about, since they are people who are probably more familiar with court workload studies and other things, as to is there some possibility of court consolidation or judicial district consolidation in the state of Oregon, which would make some sense to provide better efficiency for the state of Oregon in delivering its judicial system to the public. So, you don't have to answer that right now unless you want to, but I might ask you, as the chair, if you would be interested or the committee would be interested in reconvening to maybe take a brief overview of that particular piece within the next month to wrestle with that issue.
Yeah, it's somewhat beyond what we've ever done before. And, you know, my initial reaction is that it may not be the efficiency saving that you think, you know, it's a fair question and something I'll think. I'll pull out my map and obviously the Eastern Oregon counties are the ones, and you know, when I talk to those judges and the circuits that they do and drive, I'm just immensely impressed. And certainly the one that's Hood River, that Wasco, Morrow, Gilliam, and Wheeler County, and the dedication that they have. I mean, they really feel it's important to show up in Fossil and hold court there now and then. And it's a major event for the community. It may be as close to, you know, the community centered justice as you get, but it's a real challenge. And you know, consolidation concerns me. It's sort of gone the other way lately, and for various reasons. But you know, I'll chew on that.
Well, I'd be interested if you'd run it by the committee.
There's a disproportionate,
as Representative Butler pointed out, there's disproportionate representation from his district. But nonetheless, I think this committee is probably more well versed in looking at court consolidation than most other people would be. So I'd be interested to hear should your particular commission decide to tackle another.
Okay, I mean it would be a tough analysis of filings and what we thought. I don't know if we can get into those opinions or not, but I'll sure think about it.
I appreciate it.
Chair, I would point out that Niger is ninth on the list, Niger Circuit, needing a halftime, and that's, I'm going to guess, in part because of the opening of the Snake River Correction Facility, since that has been a two-judge circuit for some time, with the additional 3,000 beds that we have in the prison there. That is a major workload, but it's also a major workload on our district attorney staff. That's created a tremendous I'll tell you what, those folks probably don't walk on water every day, but they come pretty close to it. It doesn't have to be wintertime. They do a good job.
And Representative Butler, I really agree. I mean, that's kind of why I highlighted the Umatilla-Morrow. When you have a prison in your district, it adds a lot of work and burden to it.
And I'll just be frank with you, Mr. Wilson, that is, I just do not know how we keep a district attorney and staff in Niger County with the workload. And I know how dedicated all of these people are and how they seek for alternative kinds of methods of getting the water to the end of the road, but it's a really a very, very difficult situation for the district attorney and his staff because, well, I mean, what do you have to offer them? Is there a lot of skiing or beautiful beach shores or something like that? I mean, you're in the high desert in eastern Oregon, and that's got to be its own reward.
Well, it's tomorrow, if I can get my work done, I'm hoping to go over to Juntura and see if I can find some trout. But
as long as there's some water in the stream, I hope you can find them. I think there should be.
We have to go up to Beulah or someplace.
Up above Beulah, I'm sure there is. And the spillway. I want to trade. I want to trade. Swap lives with him afterwards. If I could.
I'd be happy to let you do that.
I got a better fishing spot for him.
I'm all ears at some point. But yeah, got work to do here. I understand.
Well, the chair appreciates that Jackson County is at the head of the list as they were during the last legislative session, even though 6 new judgeships were created. But that goes without saying as to the politics within this building. So.
Well, but it also reflects the growth down there. I mean, that's what we look at, and that's why we make our recommendations. It adds a lot of work for the district.
The chair, since he is from Jackson County, appreciates that. Anything else? Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. I was just going to mention in our budget, Chief Justice's budget document, pages 315 and 316 summarize the new judgeship request. And on page 316, as is in the report, one of the things that the Gleaves Committee does is it looks at total judicial resource needs. So it makes recommendations not only on judgeships but also on pro tem needs. If they have less than a full judgeship need, and they also make recommendations on continuing juvenile referee positions. So on page 316, it also shows, as I think Representative Butler was saying, the 0.5 FTE, which are pro tem dollars that we request to set aside for those jurisdictions to maintain a certain level of workload. Now that I'm getting to staffing, how come I'm all alone? I think it's because we've lost staff. I thought it was important to get...
Kingsley, are we going to walk through any of this particular piece?
This was just pulling together some of the comparators I had mentioned on Monday. The first page was something the National Center sent us in the last couple of days, which I thought was really important, the case weights. And I did ask them about California because that was the only place in the post-conviction relief where we looked. Our minutes were substantially higher. And I found out they had a separate weight for habeas corpus, which is makes sense that it would be smaller because you don't have to go through all the filings. And they also have law clerks down there. And so by the time it gets to the judge's time is considerably less. And in Oregon, very few districts have an opportunity for law clerks. And law clerks can spend a lot of time winnowing down those types of filings and the issues. So that was the only one I saw that jumped out as a large difference. And then the next two pages were what I'd referenced, the populations on the right, the table of state populations, and comparing that. Oregon, Connecticut, and Oklahoma were kind of on either side of Oregon in their population. Now, on the left, Oklahoma does not have its information on the number of judges, though I did pick up their court structure from a document. But Connecticut, which is primarily state-funded and unified at the trial court level, which had less population than Oregon, the next less had 175 judges compared to, they printed 164, and I think they counted the tax court judges, one of our circuit court judges, because that's the level he is in the jurisdictional train. So, and this just showed the judges per 100,000 population and then the average of filings per judge at the time. This was in year 2000. And because I'd referenced that on Monday, I thought I'd give you, even though it's, I would give you the printouts from that. And then I just went and picked up the court structures for those, for Oregon and those two states. So one, like I said, is more unified than the other, which is Oregon's court structure and the number of judges, and then Connecticut's and Oklahoma's. And Connecticut, I noted, even though it's, it says it has 175 trial-level judges, they also have a probate court, which has 133 judges, and our circuit courts do all the probate work right now, except for a couple of county courts that still handle some probate. So I thought, and then...
It's just pretty hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison.
It is very hard.
Jurisdiction.
I thought I'd give you the best I could, which at least give some context, but it is very hard to do an apples-to-apples because of structure and funding and jurisdictional issues.
Okay.
And then the populations per judge, these were based on going, this was at the time of the judges we had as of December, and we just picked up the new ones, but we don't have the 03 population statistics for obvious reasons. And I don't have their projections, so we did those just based on what we had. So it's population, ratio of population to trial judge. This isn't in the hundreds. This is just straight one-on-one, so one trial judge for every 21,500 in the population. And then the next one was case. We had two case filings excluding the violations cases, population per cases filed. So if you look at that, it's basically for every man, woman, and child, there's approximately 10.5 filings a year. It's pretty interesting. I think a lot of those may be speeding tickets. Well, worse, so it'll probably come down. And then the last page was the total, adding back the violations back in, and that was five and a half cases per population. So.
Okay. Thanks, Susan. I think it's just instructive to know, to kind of use some of those as benchmarks. So I hope that's it. All right.
For staffing, similar sort of set up initially as for the judges. The National Center came in the 99-01 biennium and performed a staffing study. So we would have, we had not had one updated since 89. It was a very sophisticated study. It used web entry data, every jurisdiction, every clerk for a period of time. Those studies were jointly part of a budget note in 99-01 and something that we were trying to do. We were then came back and reported on those and indicated that we would use them in the 01-03 biennium for new staffing opportunities, and then in 03-05 for determining need. We came to the, let me just get the handout so I can, the first page of the handout, it says 2001 National Center Oregon Circuit Court Staff Assessment Study. This explains the basic principle of the study and what they did, and what it does, like it does for the judges, it sets up a weighted caseload model based on averages around the state that it takes to handle cases from beginning to end. And in that snapshot, it takes from filing through even post judgment activity on a case in the minutes. It also took into account all the staff, so each case type has a percent that went to accounting, technical support, those sorts of things, and it's weighted minutes. So when we look for comparators like the judge one, no one else had used, because we worked in the National Center in their past study, no one else had used as sophisticated approaches we were able to develop with them. And now new ones are being done, and I think they are using a lot of the things that we worked with the National Center to develop for our study. But I wasn't able to come up with the same sort of thing. What I thought I could still do is maybe find, it's a very kind of raw number, is average staff to judges nationally, but that's, you know, that doesn't weight a whole lot, and they are set up very differently also. Some are elected, and they get to bring their staff, and our system does not work that way. So our staff is all state employees, and the judges come and go, but the staff are based on our certain formulas now. What we've used this for, and what I've attached here, well, I just talk about the second page very quickly first. In your overview packet on, I don't need you to go back to them, but I'm just going to reference them on pages 52 and 53, we had the pie chart that took the raw filings of the courts and compared them to the National Center weights. One was on judge workload and one was on staff workload, so you could see even though violations are 50% of the overall filings, they're relatively small in the terms of workload requirements. This page takes the judge weights and the staff weights, the two studies, so you can just see on one page per page type, and these were what the relative...
James, excuse me for a sec.
We're
on this one now.
Okay, page 52 and 53, and
she's got the chart.
I thought about making them different colors, but...
Okay, all right. No, you can't use colored charts.
I know. I thought that would violate some principle,
no.
So... We've only saved the really good documents with a colored page on top.
All right. Thank you very much, Kingsley. I beg your pardon.
The judge and staff workload studies comparison of case weights, just so you can see on one page what the, in the different case types, what the workload weight for judges compared to staff. And that gives you an idea when we're talking about the, even though there is very strong judgeship needs, that the staffing is what's killed us this biennium, the cuts in our budget that we couldn't keep from going against staff FTE. And you can see why certain case types are very staff intensive. And if you don't have them to work the papers and the initial stuff before trial or for the judge's action and after the judge's action, things slow down and don't get done.
Sure. If I may, just one question relative to the caseload increases, and that's what we're talking about in part, not just the blend of the caseloads themselves, but the total number of caseloads going in 1992 to 2002 during that 11-year reporting period from 19.5 to 21.5, which is a 10% increase in cases. But I appreciate the breakdown. I'm not a lawyer. The few times I've been in court, I've been ashamed to have been there. I'm old. My question is, don't some of these cases lend themselves more to technology than other cases? And do we have some idea as to, when I look at 19,500 cases in 1992 and 21,500 cases per ratio of trial judges over 11-year an array. Do we have any feel for how much we should have been saving through technology during this time? We were investing virtually tens of millions of dollars in technology in the court system, and we would expect that that's going to save us something. Do we know what the ratio, the true ratio is, and relative to workload, based upon the technology that we had in existence in 1992, versus what that translates out to in 2002 with a 10% increase, and then which of these comparisons of case weights lends themselves, which of these types of cases lend themselves more to the use of high technology, whether it's word processing or whether it's research or other kinds of things. Is that asking too much?
Representative Patrick, Representative Butler, it's not asking too much. I don't know that I have an answer in concrete. Carl tomorrow is going to present a lot of what's happened with technology in the courts through the last three biennium. I can tell you in the last workload study had been done in 89, and it even though our computer systems started going statewide in the mid 80s, and so it what we did try to capture with our latest workload studies, it does take into account, and we would want to update it in 5 to 7 years to make sure any real changes got captured again. But we've had the same technology basically since the mid-80s. We really haven't had, and that's part of the ongoing issues. All our technology's basic systems are in COBOL, so it's better than the PERS system, but it's very stable. It's like a good old station wagon. You know, we just keep changing the tires and keep it going. The data's there. It's stable. It's networked. But they've had that in place. We've had that in place since the mid-80s. So that hasn't changed radically. What we've been able to do in the last 5 years is some new applications, some software and interfaces that let us, like the uniform court judgment we're talking about, which does save a lot of staff time because you're doing it. It's real time. It goes. You're not photocopying and mailing and doing all that. But it doesn't save judge time there so much. Judges, most all the judges now do have computers on their bench, and they can look, and it helps them manage documents a lot better. In Washington County, we had a grant many years ago to have an imaging system, so all the court documents that came in, we basically scanned and pulled up. That's pretty staff intensive to get the documents in there, but it makes the document management a lot better. So in one sense, time is saved by staff by having technology, and the more we can enter things one time in the system for the use of all, I know that's Representative Patrick's dream, especially on the criminal justice side, the better. For judges, a lot of the efficiency.
Was it a dream?
Dream. Dreams can come true. All right. Maybe not this biennium, but yeah. The judges use it more to manage information, and so they are able to do more cases in less time. I think we've had testimony in past budget hearings about that, and I think a lot of them feel that the technology has kind of squeezed the last minutes out of their day. I mean, that they're pretty maxed out now and how many they can handle. That technology may not improve that a lot more, except for things like we're doing with the video conferencing where we can do the hearings with the correction facilities in the Eastern Oregon. We have a court, well, it's really a meeting room courtroom, so we fight over it all the time, in our building, where we bring in the senior judges, the pro tem judges, and beam in the hearings and handle those long distance, and that does save money and time, so technology helps there. It helps with arraignments and things where the jails can have, instead of having to transport prisoners. But that isn't, so I don't feel like I'm really answering your question except for the weighted caseload statistics from 01 really capture what was our top of our technology at the time, and we haven't gone a lot further since then.
Mr. Chair, if I could, as I preface that remark and question by the fact I'm not a lawyer, but I have worked with enough lawyers' offices over this particular decade that I'd have to say that if they were doing things with the same technology in 2002 as they were using in 1992, they would be a whole lot less efficient than 10% more workload.
Absolutely.
And so my concern is that in the private practices, I believe that they're using technology to its absolute max that they can afford. And I know from my own experience as an accountant, if I was using the 1992 software, in addition to producing the wrong tax returns, that it would be almost impossible to be profitable, because I have to produce about twice as much in this decade as I did in the prior decade, and I have to do that through software and through the technological advances. So if it would be at all possible, maybe tomorrow with the IT folks, that would be the thing to do, but I'd like to have some feel for the direction we're going in relationship to what we're going to be capturing, what we're going to be able to produce, I want to see that we're getting something out of the millions of dollars we've expended, and I think we are. I believe that we are. But I'm wondering if 10% is the appropriate amount over the last decade. Because I believe that the judges and our staff are every bit as good today as they were, and every bit as dedicated as they were 10 years ago. The cases are probably that much more complex too. But based upon all the technology that we've got and technological advances, I'm going to guess that you've got folks like Representative Patridge and other folks who are schooled in the law that can ply their trades in such a fashion that they could look at that and say, this is really antiquated technology, and you folks, I remember when I was in the courthouse as a commissioner, we had a structural issue over all the books that we had up on the second floor. We said, now wait a minute, that can be replaced with a machine with no moving parts in effect. And that's what happened. It was that all of a sudden we got rid of thousands of tomes of the library. So anyway, I just asked that question. I would like to know that we're getting much more efficient in using the higher technology and the faster database systems and so forth. Thank you.
And then Representative Butler, I can assure you that they are trying to maximize, at least within the budgets we've given them, some judicial efficiency within their IT stuff.
And then if the IT people could kind of zero in on some of these cases and tell us which are the ones that lend themselves the very most to the higher technology improvements and advancements. Thank you.
Oops, I'm telling Carl he can leave now, start working on it.
Carl, you can leave. We're not going to call him.
I think he probably
has
it on the tip of his tongue. It is, and ironically, as we become more technologically advanced, like I think in my life, even 10 years ago now, it's like, how many hours did I spend on day just because email it? It generates access in a way that's good, but also, you don't, as you know in your offices, you don't get the letter, get to write the letter in response, and then not worry about it for 2 weeks till they write back. I mean, you're hitting reply and going to the next one, and they're coming back in again, like, what did you mean by So there is a lot more the courts have been able to do with technology, but it also has generated its own business, and the public expects to be able to do a lot more things through technology than we've been able to be funded to do. And one of the things that we're talking about when you think about advances, if we can even get to be able to pay fines online. I mean, for us, a big advance 10 years ago was to be able to get the legislature approved that credit cards could be used to pay for court costs and fees, and we did that. And now it's if we can pay online. The state has been working on the controls and security that it needs to do that, but that's one of the things we think would save a lot of time and energy of staff opening envelopes and doing all those things with citations and things if the public.
As a DA, I told several defendants it's better to have the credit companies chasing you rather than the police.
Even taking for people charged with fraud, no.
Mr. Chair, we didn't have Internet 10 years ago. We didn't have email 10 years ago. And that's what precipitates this question. I believe that the value of the people and that the work ethic is there. And I'm sure the complexity of the cases has just gone out the window, too.
Representative Hanson. Quick comment. During that same 10-year period, I know personally I've got a lot more involved with computers and stuff. I haven't noticed a great deal of increase in my leisure time. Not sure if it works that way, but I'm sure we're getting an advantage for it.
you just get to do a lot more with less leisure time.
Kinsey, I know you've walked through part of this document, but I want to understand it a little bit better. We've gotten through part of it in terms of your workload piece,
sure.
But I'm trying to understand
what you're seeing.
As we've raised, well, I think I understand to some degree what you're presenting, but by the same token, I'm trying to decide, you know, as I look at like this first page, it's saying that positive numbers basically mean that they have more FTE than.
That is compared. I was going to say
they have more FTE than they need, more FTE than is optimal.
Than others. What it does is it takes the finite number of bodies and the weights and spreads them out over the state.
So zero is optimal.
Yeah, zero means probably you're pretty close to getting your core workload done according to the how fast we're doing it in 2001. It does this, and this is based on filings, what it would take with incoming. It doesn't measure on these the pending load, which is a huge contribution. We have another sheet that we've done and looked at what percent in each of the courts the pending load represents of the different case types and the terminations, and those are things that go into a full evaluation of who's understaffed and overstaffed and who needs help. But this snapshot is if you took the 2001 filings and you took the finite number of staff and you took the weights of what it took to get done, who would be over or under with those parameters. Now,
but,
it doesn't
but
say.
But let's like look
your,
at
your
let's look at page one and look at Lake County.
Sure.
So Lake County is 19.21.
Okay, when you say page one, are you on the very back?
Eight.
What the attachments were, one was the pre-November e-board action and one the last one's post. So this is the one on the back page is
what's
what
is
would
the
be
most, current?
Most current as of December before we hit all the 5,100 and our team. This doesn't take into account that we have any vacancies. This is what's in the Chief Justice's budget in the way of staffing numbers.
Okay, but let's look at, like, Lake County.
Okay.
It's 19.21.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got clock of us at negative 19.41 at the top.
Okay.
So my question is, Clackamas is a much more populous county than Lake County, obviously. Does Lake County have the minimum staffing it needs to get the job done, or are they overstaffed to get the job done? What does the 19.21 reflect?
From zero. So if you took their core workload, you would say they have 80% more of it. Well, I'm sorry, it's 0.8 FTE over of a person. So not a full person over what they might need. And that's 19.21% is against their total number of people, which I'll have to pull up another sheet, but I think is about 5.5 people. So out of their 5.5 people, they're 0.8 over for doing the 2001 filings. And that's 19.21% is 0.8 is relative to their 5.5 or their 6, however many people they have in their base number.
But if I add up, like, you know,
and
Columbia County, Lane mm-hmm. County, mm-hmm. Lincoln County, I mean, those are actual full bodies. If I take and say, well, I don't take anything that's above, that's below a 1, so I add up 14, 15, so I add up 15 positions.
Right.
In this first column
13.
That are below 0. Right? So if I add in.
Oh, I know what I mean.
If I add in Deschutes,
if you look
Lincoln, Lane, and Columbia. So that's 1, 2, 12, so that's 15, 16, 17 people in if you include Columbia, right?
Oh, and I should, I should explain the three different columns.
Okay.
And that might give you a perspective. On the left, it says total FTE supply versus core workload demand, and that's the one that says minus 55 people. That's taking the positions in the courts now in the Chief Justice's budget looking at the 2001 filings, like I said, disregarding pending anything else that they're supposed to do, and that's just their true number there. It excludes what we call ancillary functions like stenographic recorders and pretrial release and all those. The next one says, oh, no, I'm sorry, total FTE takes everybody, and they're down 55. The next one is taking just the people that are excluding the stenos and pretrial release and agency verification, because those are kind of what we call separate classifications, not always on the core workload demand. In other words, they can't perform other functions in the court, like a COS2 can be anything. And that's 150 down on total workload need. Then the last one is what we call the adjusted FTE supply, which takes your personnel dollars and converts them all to a single case, a single classification, the COS2, and uses your and says, then how would you compare? Now, you have to remember, courts have different COS2s, our main clericals, about 65% of our basic work force in the trial courts. Courts have tech people, they have supervisors.
Can you explain what COS2 is?
Court Operations Specialist. And it's our what I would call our generic clerical personnel in the courts.
That's a COS2 is higher than COS1.
Right.
And a COS1 is a little more generic than the generic COS2.
Right. We have fewer of them. I have a thing that says what percent, and they're our next highest. So COS2 is, like I said, about 65%, and the most common clerical one before we get into supervisors and coordinators, ADR coordinators, drug court coordinators.
That last column
just takes personnel dollars, converts them all to a single class, because these other two columns you have different. A person is not a person in personnel dollars, even though a person is a person in FTE in the first two columns, if that makes sense. I'm one FTE, and I'm a state court administrator. The person who takes the filing at the beginning of the case, it may be a COS2, a clerical, and they only count as one FTE in our system. So together, we're two FTE. Now, if you took our personnel dollars, you might have, seven or eight COS2s. So that last column takes all the personnel dollars.
I guess the core of my question is on the distribution of judicial resources, and specifically staff resources. My question is, regardless of which column you're in, like I look at Columbia County, it has 2.7 FTE no matter how you look at it, no matter how you skin the cat, Columbia County is overstaffed compared to every other judicial district. So how does that happen? And do you, as the state court administrator and the chief justice, have the ability to move those around? I know it used to be kind of that the staffing kind of followed a judge, and when you were a judge, you got X, Y, and Z. I know that that's not necessarily the case anymore. Is that correct?
Yes, that's not necessarily the case anymore.
Not necessarily the case.
But
for.
Sorry,
so when I have a judge, what do I get?
Well, it depends on the biennium. This past biennium, each new judgeship got three positions, and out of our overall allocation.
Were they distributed to that particular court?
Yes. They were JA, the judicial assistant, their main office person. They were a courtroom, two courtroom people, basically one to the clerk's office, and the other one usually is assigned to the clerk's office and goes in to staff the courtroom to take the court record. So they are really people that go with the workload that's there waiting for the judgeship. Now, we had a formula of five 2.38 more were held in abeyance per judgeship given into the central pool to the emergency board. We requested to prepare the study, and that's why I said the November e-board study, come in and distribute those new staff to the courts with the highest understaffing need. And that's why this was used for the purpose of highest need. And those nine positions in November went to Umatilla and Clackamas because their percent of over-under funding were the highest at the time by all three cuts of the picture. And the first page, which showed judicial workload and versus core workload demand, shows it's usually there's a corollary between staff need and judge need because it's case-based on the caseload. The difference in do you need the exact number in each district when you get a new judgeship really depends on your caseload mix. It went like in Umatilla, they would probably need more staffing than average because of the post-conviction relief because those are very staff-intensive. And another jurisdiction, because of its overall staffing number, may be able to absorb a new judgeship with fewer staff assigned to it. What this doesn't show, because like I said, this is relative need. What is your need of what you're under compared to what you already have? Well, NOMA has a huge need that we can never fill. Under this, they don't look because when you're so much, when you're saying relative weight, because you're comparing it to a pool of already 200 people, and if you need one or two compared to 200 people, that's not a very high percentage. But if you're only a four-person court and you need one or two people, that's a huge percentage of your overall need. Well, so this is what this was used
for. No, but I understand that. But there's no indication based upon this what's base level and what's not. I guess that gets to the
question. No, I was trying to distill your document
But that's what gets to the consolidation issue, at least in my mind, is to say, is for you now to take this and identify for me what the base needs are of these particular courts in the jurisdictions. Because I still don't rationalize how Columbia County, no matter how you slice it.
They have a tech person that they split with two other districts. Some of these jurisdictions, we have tech people that then
is that reflected in the numbers?
No, they show in Columbia County because they're assigned to Columbia County. So they show in Columbia County's workforce number. They also, at the time, split a pretrial release and a verification person with Clatsop and Tillamook. So that isn't reflected in here because they have a base assignment, and then they're, like Malheur County, we've tried to keep funding a person there who's kind of the tech person who goes out to the eastern Oregon counties and helps them.
Do you have a way to redistribute the FTE?
The chief and I do, each biennium. What we've tried to do is...
I mean, does your personnel system allow you to...
To reassign?
To assign your FTE based upon which judicial district they're receiving payment from?
Oh, so like your tech person... Yes, in the payment system, you could apportion a certain percent of the dollars to that county and do it that way. I mean, and some are like that. Some of our positions are paid from several different funding sources. But like Columbia counties, other counties didn't pay for it. They just were left there and paid there and funded there to take care of these other two. Now that person's been in our cuts, has been reduced to 0.5, and now those other counties have put in requests for tech people to support them because there's no longer, and under our budget cuts, a person that can come out there for them. So it's very interdependent, but let me just answer your history question. The staffing ratios and how they all came about when the state took over the county-funded systems, you inherited. So at that time, you had some counties that were well-staffed and well-funded and started off well, and other counties that were poorly funded, and it took a long time to start making up the gap. There was a what we call kind of a mini bloodbath in the late 80s when we really did do some reallocation of staff and people were laid off and moved, and it created such a difficulty between districts that we've gone to the gentler, kinder of remove vacancies and we redistribute new positions, because now under the weight load study there really are just very little that's left out of what might someone, if someone perceived it as fat before, there's very little of that left, and now with this biennium these numbers are somewhat meaningless because of the wipeout across the state. What we did with the 450, the
cuts. So these numbers are meaningless now?
Meaningless in the sense of they're not people in about almost, you know, 27% of these places. So, yes, you can reconstruct. You can say, what do they have now and what do they need to get to a more optimal level, and what's that gap out of the vacancies they have? And you can do that, and we can provide that, because that's what we would be doing depending on
how well we do here.
Robin and I are working on an analysis tool to use, so we'll
so
give
we
you that. But
that.
I was hoping that we could get partway there with this, but it doesn't.
Well, you can with the stats that we do have. We do have it. But this does.
We'll get you the tool.
But it's always been where the Chief Justice is, by his authority in the statutes, he allocates the budgets and staffing per judicial district, and I think that's appropriate.
Maybe we'll get him a vest.
So the other things that you take into consideration is distance and minimum costs. We have group size. We have five different groups. Size courts for budgeting purposes and staffing purposes, because there's a minimum level, as we talked about on Monday, for just having your court doors
yeah.
open.
We can move on from this. Unless Representative Hansen has a question.
Well, just a quick comment, and that's kind of my experience with counties, is as long as we're basing the organization of services on counties, it becomes very, very difficult. There are such a variety of sizes and shapes and distances and population that it's incredibly difficult to ever allocate something precisely as long as you're using county lines. I mean, we don't get every 10 years to go through and rebalance the counties according to population. So that becomes almost an impossible task. I would think if we were really looking at reorganization concepts, it might be better to focus in like the metropolitan area. Would there be any merit to a single small claims court in the metro area, or certain functions where the distances aren't incredible for anybody, but are there economies of scale if you were if you could cross district lines with different functions? But that's probably more of a revolution than even
metro service district for small claims.
Well, that type of a concept. Mm-hmm. If there are economies of scale, and then to a certain point, you've got to balance the economies of scale with the inconvenience to the customers.
And then staff fee.
Representative Butler.
I just want to clarify one thing, and that is that when I look at that list, the same numbers 26 shows up in the with identical figures on all three columns. And if I have 3.5 or 4.5 staff, which are actually 4.5 different FTE, and I'm strong by 8/10 of one FTE, Wouldn't I just go ahead and lay off of a half? Is that what this doesn't say, that I'm actually going to just remain strong by 8/10 of an FTE when I've got folks that are in there for a half FTE? Does it, Kingsley?
This is the thing that this is doing is measuring against a finite total. It's not measuring it against a goal. So, I mean, first you have to decide, what is your goal? Is your goal that the cases get done in this time of period statewide? If so, you look at each jurisdiction and what is the staffing need to get to that goal and put that into the model. What this does is take the number that we have now and say, in reference to this other county.
Isn't your goal your core workload? I mean, zero is your goal. Your core workload, isn't that your goal?
I thought it was.
Well, if you don't want them to do anything else, right. Travel over to Klamath, but yes, zero is a goal for your core. There are other things that the courts do that would not be measured in the core, but not a whole lot.
But it doesn't measure
your... What we do in our model is we'll add in, when you've got like four different facilities that staff has to travel between and take files, we'll put in a factor for the travel, because you can use over a year's time maybe a whole staff person just in the travel between facilities where you hold proceedings. And then, like you mentioned, between places of holding court, like in Umatilla, Morrow, if you go to Hermiston and those, I mean, there are some static staff, and then there's some staff that travel with the judge and go for the hearing. So we do add in factors. So Lake is one where there's a little, there is for the core a little more FTE than would be, but right now with our budget cuts, that's not really the case.
And I think Lake was a county where you were moving people, which you indicated doesn't show here, but you were moving people from one court to another. So if they were assigned to Lake and serving in Klamath, 105, 110 miles away, I mean, you got, number one, a lot of windshield time, but also the fact that they're still assigned to Lake but serving in Klamath. So you might have a half FTE that's assigned there but actually working somewhere else, and with the travel time, that's going to
zero
out.
And their filings are so low comparatively. Like I said, there's a minimum cost to open your door open, and that may look like overstaffing, but if you want more than one person to be there all week, you need to have that other body in there.
I had an accounting question, Mr. Chair, and that is this. If I've got people working in the TriMet areas or in some of these areas where there is separate taxation, do you actually separate their payroll for TriMet purposes so that when they're serving in TriMet, then they're paying the TriMet tax? When they're serving in another jurisdiction, they're not, and vice versa. When you bring Judge Aragwin in pro tem and have him serve in one of those counties, then he's paying TriMet, I assume.
We do our each of our positions, depending on the taxing district they are, that we do, it is part of the OPE, part of their overhead costs. The judicial department pays it based on where their primary base position is. So when he travels, it doesn't make any difference.
Could be working in the TriMet and you're not paying a TriMet tax for his employment?
We're paying for the judge whose employment he's sitting in for.
I see.
Because he's coming in to hear a case that another judge had a conflict or is absent, but we're already still paying for that initial judge's costs as a tax district. Now I'll look at Gail.
TriMet lets you do that?
Complexity to it than that, but that's our basic state. And I don't know that there's any difference with other state employees and how those agencies handle that. I mean, it's your primary resume. But like I said, they're coming in to substitute for a reason. For
Mr. Chair, I would guess that you're going to, if Multnomah County were to pass a 1.25% income tax, that system wouldn't work anymore. So you maybe ought to take a look at your system. Those folks that we should be paying the tax on, we ought to be paying the tax on. Those folks that aren't drawing their basic compensation in a taxed area probably shouldn't be paying the tax when they're not serving in that area. So I would say the system sounds fine. I don't know that it'd hold up. I don't know that it'd hold water in an audit.
It's a state payroll system, so I don't. Maybe yeah. LFO staff knows. I mean, they.
two quick.
And I don't know if their computer system can adjust for that or not.
two quick comments.
Yeah.
I think when we're looking at a $30 million deficit in court services, we probably aren't going to solve it in Lake County.
Come on.
The other one is, I think the way the Multnomah County tax is structured, that even state legislators, when they're thinking about Multnomah County issues, will be paying the payroll tax on that portion of time if they're thinking about Multnomah County. But the allocation of it will be difficult, but I think we'll be able to get to it.
I guess ultimately, Kingsley, what the question to me is if this, you know, I know that there's some distribution of resources in some courts that have better resources than other courts in the state. And I guess the question, the question that I have is, like, when you went through your 5,100 cuts, how did you distribute
how did you distribute those cuts? And say we're only able to give you half of what the Chief Justice's recommended budget is, how do you then redistribute hiring those positions back to courts? I mean, I'm interested in seeing what that model looks like so there's some equity statewide that meets the basic analysis. But
Chair Patridge, if you gave us back 60 positions, under normal practices, you would give them to the Chief Justice and I to distribute according to the formula of need and set them back up that way. That's how the November board was done, and that was how the direction was from the last, for the purpose of the study and what we should do with new resources. If that makes sense.
Oh, I mean, that makes sense.
And you
I guess
give
that
us
makes sense,
a
but
position number, and we could say, based on what we have right now and fields, how would those go back?
But when you did the cuts, did you take all this into account? Or did you do across the board cuts to local jurisdictions?
We had a modified approach. We used the Budget Reduction Advisory Committee. The first round of cuts were across the board because that's how we usually, that's been our, I would say, judicial conference, but it's really the presiding judges, TCAs, and the State Court Administrator and Chief Justices agreed to guidelines for reduction environments that we would spare the Group 1 courts, which are the smallest size courts, usually with one judge, and that everyone above that would have a across-the-board cut. And then we also looked at what we call discretionary items that aren't personnel-related that we could cut first on a statewide basis before we had to reach personnel. But then when we reached personnel, that would just be distributed across the board for the first round. We've never faced the level of cuts that we had to do before for the 4055 cuts that took 60 people out of the vacancies. Those were taken to a large extent from the courts that had provided vacancies that were over the formula than under the formula.
Over or under which formula?
The staffing percent basis of need. I mean, everyone had a need.
The staffing formula?
Right.
Okay.
But since, and then after that, we said there was $3 million in across-the-board cuts out of this last one that everyone had to just go in and cut staff. $2 million was across, in addition to that, $3 was the going to 90% all staff. So we saved another 113 bodies across the board from that. And then the rest were made up in one-time savings, overall state vacancy savings. So that's why I said it was modified. But across the board, case
generally, though,
related,
it was done across the board.
Generally,
but for vacancy savings. And okay. So I guess my question is, and your my concern is, if we give you the money back to reallocate and rehire people, that it's done so that more of this list shows up as zero rather than a bunch higher and a bunch lower.
If it's zero, you would have to also add in another 60 over and above what the Chief Justice's level.
No, I understand pieces and parts of that, but my question, I mean, I've heard historically Lane County has always, because they have more judges, I think, than other jurisdictions of their type based upon the political winds of this particular
story in this
body, that they've also had more staffing generally as a result of that, because usually staffing went with judges.
Correct.
But my concern is, as we come back and redistribute the chief needs to answer this, but as we come back and redistribute the money, if we're able to refill, that it just doesn't go out on a across the board basis, but it goes out on a basis that more equitably reflects the workload needs of the particular courts.
intended. So do we have...
That would be our
plan. Is that the plan?
Yeah, that would be our plan. I think he wants your voice on the record.
I want your voice on the record on this one, on the fact that if we are able to restore the money for the courts and restore the positions, that as we look at those will be redistributed on based upon workload, not necessarily based upon how many judgeships they have or those types of items.
The vacant positions.
Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll let you guys get back to us on that or we got a work session, but... That's part of my concern, is we have some haves and have-nots.
Chair Wallen Carson, Chief Justice, members of the committee, that appeals to me. We chose some time ago, because we've always been understaffed as a unit by almost any standard statewide, to build rather than take away. That was my decision made because 10, 20, 15 years ago we reallocated, and as Click has indicated, it was disruptive both to the gaining counties or districts and to the losing districts. The way things were going, we were so far behind, in my view, of being staffed adequately for the caseload that we handled, that the way to do it was to allocate new staff and fill in those vacancies rather than taking them from different counties. And that's what you've seen in the budgets over the last five or six sessions. I mean, we've been asking for it, of giving this, it's now called critical work staff, but it's designed on bringing up, if we had some people that were fat and were way overstaffed, yes, that would appeal to me. I don't think we do. I think the ones that have more are pretty close to right or still below what they ought to be at, but there are others acknowledged, as you correctly pointed out, we have some others that are grievously understaffed. And we have all the unique things like Clackamas County. If we got them, we don't know where we'd put them. We're going to have a mine shaft up there to put these people in, and that's both judges and staff. Mm-hmm. But my hope was is that as we continue to grow, as we are, that we would be able to convince the legislature that we had critical staff needs, and they were indeed hooked on your model. Where do we need these people to bring them up to the level, rather than going in and making every county understaffed, so that we could then say we have some counties that were much more understaffed, now they're only some understaffed. We may have to do that, and that may be the answer you're talking about, is we have a new level. Here's what we need. We think we can build a lesson for. We're never going to get there. We're going to be chronically understaffed in everything we do. So then we'll come in here, and this is the model we go to, and we'll redistribute staff to meet the low one. And that might be the most equitable. You have me rather taken, because the legislative aspect that we fear the most is as Salem becomes smaller in your rearview mirror when you go home, you hear the word, by the way, cut your budgets 10% across the board. Doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. So I have to agree with you that your managed, if you will, application of or redistribution is far superior. It has some management involved in it rather than just cut off the top part of your head and hope it survives.
I'm hoping that we can raise the votes equally.
Well,
if we're able to give you that opportunity, to, if we're able to create within this budget environment to do that, so that you can bring everyone at least to a base level. But when I understand some of the chronic understaffing issues that we have dealt with, not only this session but previous sessions, and so I'm happy to do that, but we've discovered many haves and have-nots in this committee, not just in the judicial system, but in other particular budgets. With the state medical examiner the other day, that was a very interesting discussion that we had.
Mr. Chair, I applaud the work of this committee over the years, but particularly the questions you're asking now are very good questions. I think it's we live in interesting times. The Chinese curse, I think it's probably our mantra. For instance, I would very much like to consolidate, but Multnomah County is one of the glittering, not with no fault of Representative Hansen, is a glittering one. Gresham does not want consolidation of judicial services in Multnomah County, and they'll kill to keep it in East County. So while on one hand we can make the argument for consolidating, who would like to come to downtown Portland? You know, you have to call up the state police and see whether they can get in or get out, or whatever it may be.
We'll let them have their own special taxing district.
That'd be good.
If they want to pay for their judge, they can do it.
But this is fun in the sense that we're going to some bedrock Oregon values or policies, and that is, for instance, and I'll be shocked for this, we could make a lot of money by closing every courthouse. Take the 27 districts or the 36 courthouses and close 15 of them, half of them, because if you did an economic study on them, they don't make money. They never will make money. But talk to my cousin in downtown Fossil, and I say that, and everybody doesn't get it if they're not there, because there is no uptown Fossil. But
I get it.
In downtown Fossil, that's a centerpiece, as Tim Willis was talking about, that is a very important part of the fabric of Wheeler County. And for a kid from Salem to say, well, just shut them down, they're not making any money, the economic model, if you will, ain't Oregon. Those are important parts of the community. So that's the fun part about it. We have to be careful whether we're building or taking apart, is are we meeting the needs of the people? That's a challenge that you've enjoyed for some time.
I understand the challenge, and as the kid from Medford who has to look at it and say that there's no sustaining revenues, and the people of Fossil and other places across the state are unwilling to support the infrastructure that we have, that's an issue. So they can complain all they want, and people can complain, but they got to support it. So,
thank you.
Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah. One of the advantages I could see to relooking, especially in the metro area, service delivery, since you touched on the chronic need for facilities, and I'm wondering if there are some functions of the court that could maybe be conducted in cheaper facilities that might not need, like a small claims court, probably wouldn't need the same level of security as a full service court. Are there some functions that either could be consolidated and then maybe in completely separate locations that wouldn't require the same type of space needs, security needs, functions that might not be involved with the jury, that and again, not worry so much about the county boundaries, even a Gresham court. If it was serving citizens, maybe some citizens from Clackamas County, it might be more economically functional. That I don't know whether the county lines are as incredibly important now as they were 50 years ago.
A statutory jurisdiction and the statutes require things to be filed in the county or where the crime committed and those sorts of things, you'd have to change that, but the chief is going to answer
nothing,
about your facility.
Nothing we're going to do this session, but but in terms of a view for the future.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Hansen, the answer to your question is yes, from an economic jurisprudential standpoint. From a political standpoint, I don't know. And when I was here, I introduced a bill because 70% of the people in Polk County live in West Salem. So I had the idea, let's consolidate Marion and Polk counties, which made a lot of sense because they all lived within 2 miles of the courthouse, but they had to drive 14 miles to go to to Dallas to the courthouse. It was a lot more convenient. They were talking about building an addition to the Polk County Courthouse at the time. It was going down, but when Carson's plan to consolidate the two counties hit the press, they were marching in the streets, and that ballot measure to build an addition to the Polk County Courthouse and not consolidate the two counties carried substantially, and there was a time that I didn't venture into Polk County until the heat dissipated somewhat. So I caution, and you've already alluded to it, so I know you know it, those traditional boundaries might as well be walls. It's hard to explain in today's world. Electronics ultimately will be the breach to allow us to deal across county lines, ultimately state lines, but now county lines. We are trying, for instance, one thing, an advisory committee that hasn't met on the criminal justice side for some time, so we've been so busy with the Public Defense Service Commission establishment, is looking for people who violate probation, have the discourtesy to violate probation requirements in several counties simultaneously. they aren't very thoughtful of the court system. And we want to establish a system where you could go to one, Marion County, and dispose of your probation violations in Clackamas County, in Jackson County, in Malheur County, or whatever it may be. We're having trouble getting it. One could say from a logic standpoint, well, of course you can. But you have statutes and you have other aspects that you have DAs that have different views of how things, as they could have and should have. And so you're right on. I agree with you, and I wish we could do more of it. And I think ultimately electronics, where we can go to an ATM and you can pay your traffic ticket anywhere in Oregon by punching in the right jurisdiction and pay it, and then we won't have to worry. But that's the tail end. The front end is very important. You're entitled to be charged in the county in which you live or in which you committed the crime on the criminal side. But you're on the right track. I wish you well, and I'm there with you. It's just that my experience has taught me that for no other reason than tradition, we have 36 counties, and we're not likely to add any nor take it away. The biggest movement was when they were going to have the state of Jefferson. This is not new in Oregon. Your home county wanted to break away and take Northern California and Southern Oregon and form a new state. State of Jefferson.
They still do.
Well, I was going to, yeah, right. I'm rattling on that.
We're in the form of a motion. I'll second.
I'm with you, too.
There you go.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to know, there is nothing restricting, if the court wanted to do a small claims bureau in Multnomah County. There's nothing restricting the court from doing that now.
No, we can put the small claims in anywhere in Multnomah County if we want to do it, and there's some good reason for it. Every study that's been done, and there are many of them that have been done, the building that Multnomah County is, it used to be where the commissioners were, is probably place number one. Everybody wanted to be on the first floor, and they probably will be after the first tremor, because it is a very dangerous building. They've looked to move it, even renting, taking a leaf from education and renting some double wides and moving it out. When you incorporate who uses it, such as the sheriff's office, the first problem you run into is the sheriff, if we're talking about taking misdemeanors, community courts, for instance, which is a wonderful idea in Multnomah County, with District Attorney Mike Shrunk, and starting with Don Launder and Jim Ellis and now Dale Kosh, and that's probably going to get eliminated. But those areas that were moving out of downtown, going into the community, right idea. Expensive. You have to send DAs out there, defenders out there, judges out there, and so they may be a victim or a casualty under this restructuring. But no, there's no reason other than money that would keep us from relocating. Well, there are reasons, traditional reasons, from relocating to some more economical spot, much as you authorized some time ago the state office building to move over to East Portland, because there was no requirement that it be in West Portland, where it traditionally did. So it moved east. So that could be done. But the first thing I would want to do is consult with county commissioners and former county commissioners and see what the people in Multnomah County would want us to do. But we literally could have, we now have, I think there's small claims in fashion. So we have.
Doug's,
yes. And we could open them up. We'd have other sites. But I hear this committee, at least, not necessarily supporting, but talking about, is consolidation. So if you're going to consolidate districts, then one would argue that theme would be you would consolidate small claims. There would be one place in the metro area where you do small claims. I don't think that's right. That would take a lot of statutory changes. But we can go where you represent the people, and we're interested in what your thoughts are and where you think we can make the economy and yet serve the people. For instance, I say, economically, if I were to use my calculator, I could pretty well demonstrate there are a whole bunch of courts that could be closed. But from a political standpoint, from a people standpoint, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think we should. And so that's a higher cost that we pay, we foist on you, to have a courthouse in Fossil, Elm County, or or maybe it's important to those people, I think.
And ironically, one of the most popular programs in Multnomah is the community courts, where they taking and sentencing and hearing things out in the community on the offenses, the property offenses, and those sorts of things. And that's, Doug could tell you more about that, but I mean, just the staffing related to doing that and moving files. So in some ways, what we've been trying to do is expand our ability to go and hear in other places that bring it more home to the citizens that are affected by the crime or the case type. So it is. It's a balancing act on access and accountability and meaning to people's lives. And the other thing, just to mention on Multnomah, when we talk about consulting, I mean, they do have the separate jail, and you know, the jail facility where they do the hearings and things at the highest security levels there, and then the courthouse, and then they've got the juvenile facility, and then, of course, they've got Gresham for the reasons the chief mentioned that they don't want to come to downtown Portland. No. So all those things, I mean, take a certain level of staffing and judging just to move and manage the huge number of filings that they have. And Doug, I know, could speak more about whatever consolidation. I maybe that's something Doug can maybe tomorrow can speak to a little bit about. If you see any possibilities for consolidation in that area. So Multnomah sits among itself as like 25% of our whole filings and budget, and every other court, even the large ones in Washington and Clackamas, just pale. I mean, it's Multnomah, that's the state that should happen, and then the rest of the state is more even in where it can go. So,
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because so many states are facing the same thing we are, shortages of money, same problems of overcrowded courts. Has there been anyone out there who's done a study as to what the potential is for electronic, for remote location trial? Some of these things particularly, like we can go home and turn on our TV and watch somebody who agreed to go before somebody who isn't really a judge, when we call them judge somebody, and they actually decide a case. And my curiosity is, anybody actually study what the potential of that is?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, Senator George. It's been of great interest. The alternatives to jury trials have been studied and restudied. I would not want to start with the Judge Judy's of this world, which is the worst thing that's happened to the judicial department nationally.
I wasn't going to televise it, by the way. But
No. Well, it's entertainment, and the people sign up for it, and just as you outlined, and they agree privately to be bound by whatever the person rants and raves and reaches a decision of some sort. There are a number of things that have happened. First of all, we've been pushing ADR, appropriate dispute resolution, as a good tool to use, and I believe it is part of our future, that you might hear from Pamela Abernathy. Central piece, technology and ADR, the central pieces, the biggest change. When we wrote our study, and Representative Butler mentioned it, in our initial vision study, we didn't mention the word Internet. We didn't know that Al Gore had invented it, and so it isn't even mentioned 10 years ago, which is your point. That's right. But it's an integral part of how we do business now, and will become even more so. So technology and ADR are critical to meeting our needs, and they are having an effect. We have, and we didn't create it, CDRCs, conflict disposition.
Community dispute resolution center.
Thank you, community dispute resolution center. I would take it a step further, and I'd put them in the schools, so we could use the school building facilities more often. I'm then dismissed as some sort of a lunatic, because I have some other ideas on school buses and lunches and libraries that are used for schools that would become community assets and not school assets. I won't go there. But in any event, we'd like to drive it out. That's the way to cut costs. That's the way to keep our caseload, and actually a way to get happier litigants because they have a part in reaching the decision. There are things we've had for 15 years called a maybe 20 years reference judge, so you can go offline, off an approval list, and if the parties agree and are willing to pay it, you can get a private citizen who is on a lawyer, recently, because it's my view, a resident of Oregon, can decide your case, and when it's filed, it has the same effect as a circuit judge's order. All kinds of different things we're trying to use, and small claims are very important, and I think you've heard, but I'll tell you now, in many communities, somewhere around 70% of small claims are resolved, well, a huge percentage is resolved by default. Nobody ever shows up. Those that are litigated, if you will, the go to hearing, I think it's Marion County, 70-80% are resolved by volunteer pro bono mediators. It's the staff to make it work that's cutting us off at the legs. So, yes, there are ways. The role model, I think, although Oregon has been out in front, is Maricopa County, which is Phoenix in Arizona, has done some marvelous stuff and they have a county system. They don't have a state system. So this is when you say Flagstaff may not do it, but Maricopa County does it, and they have done very well in bringing technology into helping the courts. So we kind of like to do that, although the computer people say I get too far out ahead, and you were talking before, some of the things I am projecting out now are in the boneyard. They are no longer recognized as an advanced in the computer system. They've turned from analog to digital or whatever it may be. So we're in tune to that because that's good customer service.
Yes, I appreciate you exploring this with us, and we will continue to do it. I think we, in this budget environment, we leave no stone unturned, and we're looking at cutting institutions and programs in light of the current revenue situation. And as much as I don't want to see these school buses in between routes with children in Representative Butler's district circling around out there in eastern Oregon on the felon route, picking up all the felons to bring them to the local courthouse, and the school buses are a community asset. It is not something I want to see done, but I think that is a policy choice that we need to put forward and let people make some decisions about, because, as you said, in an economic model, there are some efficiencies that can be gained. But we have to make the policy decision in this environment whether we want to whether we can afford to continue to protect those institutions. So I think that's where we're faced with. I know you have Judge Abernathy, who I see in the back, as well as Judge Collins here. And I know we have very limited time left. I know that we don't have the time for their full presentation, but I want to make sure that they get the opportunity. So I know that their schedules and dockets are very, very busy. We could have a hearing on Friday, though. Since the court's closed, they would have plenty of time on Friday.
I got all day on Friday. So. But,
if they would like to come up and have an abbreviated presentation, I want to make sure that they get heard.
I apologize for taking their time.
You weren't taking their time. I asked you to come up.
We asked the questions.
Thank you so much for my 10-minute overview.
We've had a thoughtful discussion.
Yes. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Now I know we've done did my school bus bill relative to transit.
All right.
Well, let me introduce Mr. Chair, if I may. You're now right here, two of our folks that have been at the vanguard of judicial education, visioning the future of the court system and how they operate. And they are seasoned veterans in the judicial system, and I rely on both of them and others for their input and their expertise. I was going to give you some remarks from the Federalist's papers, but I'll save that for another day. But any lull in the conversation, I'd be glad to fill in. But these two people are some of our best, and so I'll leave it over. You're starting, John, or
yes.
Emily?
Yes, thank you, Chief. And good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm John Collins. I'm the presiding judge in Yamhill County and also a member of the Chief Justice's Budget Reduction Advisory Committee. I've been asked to frame the policy decision central to this budget process. I appreciated Representative Patridge's last remark seemed like a great segue into this about how it really is a question of policy and priority, and there's much sorting out to be done. I do understand that over the past 2 days, you, as a part of this enormous challenge to construct a budget for all three branches of government, have been hearing about the mission and values of the judicial branch. You've heard about the BRAC process of setting priorities consistent with our priority on public safety, set in response to the question of what do we not do when we have insufficient funds for staff and resources to perform all we're called upon, primarily by the legislature, to do. It's been a painful process of development, and even more painful process, speaking as a trial judge and a presiding judge who's been in the system for over 30 years, to see implemented on a daily basis. We're forced to abandon or defer providing justice services to areas we have long regarded as fundamental to the citizens that we serve, most notably non-person misdemeanors, more serious crimes involving alleged offenders that must be released and deferred due to lack of funding for indigent defense counsel, and small claims, the only court forum for the common man, woman, and business. As we move into the next biennium, we approach our task anew. We have reassessed priorities based on principles and values, again with a priority on the protection of public safety. We are asked again, what can we now not do? We were initially anchored to a governor's budget that would require us to not provide justice services in four areas: post-conviction relief, small claims, property-only domestic relations, and half of all civil cases. The policy decision for the legislature then becomes, will we fund these services? And if not, then who will and how? Stated otherwise, we asked that if the legislature decides not to fund these functions, then either abandon them altogether or decide how they'll be handled by someone else. Post-conviction relief statutes were developed over time as a product of old writs of habeas corpus in an effort to isolate from the appeals process those issues more attributable to criminal prosecution and defense that fell below constitutional standards, such as the area of inadequate assistance of counsel. Frankly, it's a good sign that few cases are successful. But of those that are, they represent a fundamental denial of due process that's a fundamental cornerstone of our system of justice. I submit that we cannot constitutionally forego this process. If reassigned, it would be reassigned to an administrative body that would not likely be less costly than the courts. Small claims court, that's the people's court, discredited at times by the cantankerous Judge Judy, is still the best forum for the common man, woman, and business. In my county last year, we had 2,000 such cases filed. Businesses and citizens whose disputes do not warrant costly counsel and more formalized proceedings can obtain quality justice at discount prices. Shifting small claims to municipal or justice courts is an option, but not one universally available. There are no justice courts in many counties, such as mine. While McMinnville and Newburgh have fine law-trained municipal judges, that's not universally true throughout the state. People outside the two cities in my county will not have access to a court under those circumstances. If one was created, it would probably come to depend upon revenues from traffic cases that now are one of the few black ink items on the current state court's jurisdiction. Property-only domestic relations, in other words, usually divorces, currently are the subject of arbitration under state law. But I'm not convinced this is the best alternative because of the cost of arbitration for simple cases of who gets the toaster, who gets the waffle iron. The legislature could devise, as is done in many states, an administrative arbitration process, but this would not be a particular savings, I don't believe, only a shift. General civil. Again, arbitration addresses many of these cases, but not all. Many involve issues of equitable remedies not subject to arbitration currently. These decisions can be critical issues of contract, property rights, and personal injury. Arbitration and mediation are important alternatives, but if all are shifted to this, the tougher cases will be without real remedy and justice. I close, then, in an effort to frame this policy issue with this blunt question to you, the policymakers. Do you really want to dismantle these segments of our justice system and or assign them elsewhere?
They may not be attractive cases, but for the litigants, they are a critical part of what Americans look for in their courts, for a dispute resolution, for cases they can't settle amongst themselves, and for justice. I would urge these considerations as you approach the very difficult task of the budget process ahead, and I'd be glad to respond to questions.
Thank you, Judge Collins. Question, Judge Collins?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. I don't know that this is a question of Judge Collins, but just a comment, and I appreciate your thoughtful analysis and input and the way this has been put together, but I keep coming back to the fact that in this environment, this fiscal environment in which we find ourselves, we've got to find a new way to skin a cat. And I'm just not certain how that's going to come about, but I've got to believe that there's almost, and you've touched base on a couple of items, nibbled around the edges, but I think that there's really something I'm missing in this whole process that we're going to have to do. It's time for us, no more business as usual. We're going to have to make some changes, and I'm still looking for it. It's here somewhere. I think we're going to get to it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Butler, if I could comment, I appreciate your comments, and I especially, I salute the Herculean task you all have in dealing with the budget ahead. You mentioned a new way to skin the cat. I know I, at least at times, like to think of this like Chinese food or French food. Those are two of the world's great cuisines that were born out of periods of famine. And so maybe in this difficult time we will indeed learn how to do business better in a better way that produces a better product. My hope, though, is that in the process we don't lose important qualities of justice that the courts are called upon to deliver, and in particular in these four areas that are most vulnerable to cut.
Absolutely have to maintain that, don't we? Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Abernathy?
Chair Patridge and members of the committee, I'm Pamela Abernathy. I've been a trial judge for 10 years in Marion County. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak to you. I think I'm preaching to the choir. I think they picked me to be here today because I'm an American history major. I'm here really just to give you some ammunition, perhaps, with others, because after listening to you for 2 hours, I don't think that you in particular need my message. I agree with Representative Butler that, and to quote Senator Westland, we've moved from crisis to catastrophe in this state. I well understand that. And I understand that nobody is safe, and that you must examine every aspect of the functions of government in order to see if we are operating at our most efficient. I understand that, but I'm here with a message to ask you to treat the courts differently. Should we allow the people who do not want to fund state government to dismantle the courts? No. And not that we're going that far. But again, the judicial branch is the third branch of government. It is a leg on a three-legged stool that we call democracy. Justice delayed is justice denied. You've all heard that phrase. And if we adopt no more than the governor's budget, we will have those delays. Historically, the democratic process has grown with access to the courts. For those of you who didn't have to study legal history, trials used to be trials by ordeal. Then we moved to the notion that divine intervention would be, I think, both fact finder and decision maker. Then we moved to jury trials, but the jurors were actually witnesses to the event. And finally, under the Anglo-Saxon tradition of justice, we've moved to our modern court system. In Oregon, we've tried to be a leader, not a follower. And you have our vision on page 20 and 21. You at least have the overarching statement. And it is that in the 21st century, Oregon courts lead the nation in providing fair, accessible, and timely justice to promote the rule of law, protect individual rights, and resolve conflicts. We respect, reflect, and respond to the diverse people we serve. We earn public trust, build partnerships, and promote safe, caring, and engaged communities. Not only is the United States and this state founded on the rule of law, not only is a government by the people and for the people founded on citizen access to the courts, but as the vision suggests, law intersects with every single aspect of every citizen's life. And I'm not sure they get that. And that's why, again, my theme is I don't think we can allow short-sightedness in terms of funding to dismantle a system that is so central, so core to our very existence. In civil law, law intersects with the very business of living and dying, to get a driver's license, to buy and sell, to attract businesses to the state. We have to have functioning courts. And I don't think a court is functioning if we are doing every other civil case and we are californicating Oregon, to use an old expression, in the sense that it would now take 6 or 8 years to get a civil case to trial. In criminal law, as you know, you are the public safety subcommittee, obviously not prosecuting certain kinds of cases, and you've heard this on and on, so I'll just state the obvious, does create a public safety hazard to the communities we serve. Then there's the whole area of family law. Both the BRAC, the budget, the Chief Justice's Budget Reduction Advisory Committee's case listing of priorities, as well as our vision, is founded on the principle that we must first protect the most vulnerable citizens, the most vulnerable members of our communities, and that is children primarily, and also the disadvantaged, those unable to care for themselves, the elderly, the developmentally disabled. So law intersects in all of those ways in our lives. If we can't and don't preserve respect for the courts, then I don't think we will preserve the rule of law. Obviously, we're not going to get in this state or this country to the cycle of anarchy, tyranny, that we see in other countries. When you look abroad, you see nations struggling to be born and struggling to become democratic, and what's the first thing they have to do? They have to create an independent judiciary. They have to create respect for the rule of law. And if not, then you see that cycle prevail. So when we talk about what do the people want, when I ask the people's branch to look at what do the people want and how do we respond to perhaps their lack of understanding, I say, you have to be what we used to call ourselves in the trial division, that thin blue line. You have to be the dam. You have to be the barrier, and you have to say, look, we need to preserve the courts, because if we don't, we're going to erode trust in the courts, and we're going to further erode respect for the rule of law, and we're further going to erode the underpinnings of our system. If only looked at in economic terms, we must do that. What business wants to come to a state where it takes 6 years to get to trial? What business wants to come to a state, what family wants to come to a state with the business where criminals are allowed to not be prosecuted? What mother or father wants to bring a child to a state where the disadvantaged and the children of the state are not protected, where abuse and neglect is not caught early enough to have some hope of prevention, where cycles of violence are not prevented from being ongoing? So one of the sub-goals in our vision is making courts work for people. We need to preserve the courts for them, even if they don't yet appreciate and understand how central they are to the core of every aspect of our collective being. I ask you to do that for them, and thank you very much for your time.
Questions for Judge Abernathy? Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Judge Collins to help me out here because my voice is just about gone. We had a meeting in Yamhill County a month or so ago, and I asked the judge a few things because we knew this was coming. And I said to him, have you thought about doing this? We're doing it. Have you thought about doing this? We went through a whole list, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And they were doing everything that I could think of in order to streamline that court. And Do you have anything else that you might be able to help me out here?
I was waiting for the question. The answer is, I think the answer is yes. We are. We're working a lot on efficiencies, and it's not just efficiencies in how we manage our time, but also how we manage our budgets and our resources. I think we certainly take seriously, and I, as a presiding judge in particular, the trust is placed in us with the taxpayers' dollars, just as you do.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
Senator Patridge and Senator George, I just wanted to say, reference was made to Fridays. Those of us who run drug courts are going to be at Judge Collins' court this Friday, where we're going to hear from a judge from California. The topic is, how do you run a drug court on no money? So we're trying. We're trying to do it without it. So just thought that was a interesting fact you should know.
That was prompted, by the way, both by cuts in court funding, but also by cuts in Oregon Health Plan funding, which has had a real impact on drug courts.
Sir George.
Are you guys going to be in a room in the courthouse to where that might be videotaped?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we're trying to get the corrections department to videotape it for us, and it's going to be in my courtroom.
You haven't duplicated it for our members.
Very good. Be glad.
Okay. Questions? Thank you both for coming. I appreciate the testimony. We are out of time unless we had somebody else who has come from afar to testify, which I would be happy to stay listening to testimony. Otherwise, we will continue over Senate Bill 5523 until tomorrow. Continue the hearing over. Tomorrow we'll be wrapping up with the department as well as have some public testimony. So with that, we're adjourned.